At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
You didn't want to be there? But the thing was, you were always smart. That's the most important thing to me. You gotta have a decent voice. You gotta be smart.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 472 for the week of August 14th, 2023. I am Highway Ditch Pot Farmer David T. Cole, and I'm here with Flimsy Decal Sarah D. Bunting.
I'm a booster.
Quality Assurance Purpose Tara Ariano.
It's why you may be recorded.
And New Jersey Authentication Coordinator Robert Krutt.
This show needs to start with a lot of body hair.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Extra Hot Great. I wasn't expecting a reference to body hair there. Before we get into this week's TV proceedings, a little bit of pod business up top, I am pleased to report that our Patreon debacle has rubber banded back and we have collected $200 fortune in our favor. And our rejiggered goalpost milestones mean that we have hit the milestone for Kim Reed's The Most Awesome Thing I Watched on TV this month. So later in this month, we'll provide you the first of those. Assuming Patreon doesn't reshit the billing bed again at the start of September, like happened this month, which is why we were screwed up. We will turn our milestone attention to the next goal, which is the Forcening Pool, a monthly feature to the show, to the Extra Extra Hot Great Show, in which one supporter will get to force us to watch any episode of TV they want, asterisk, and we will watch it and discuss it. Plus, a one-off bonus event, a live EHG game time night. That's a night of trivia with you and us over Zoom. I will be your game master for that. So go to extrahotgreat.com/club to join today.
Thank you so much, Dave. Thank you so much, listeners, joining us. For this episode, he is a professor and a poet. You've heard with us many times before. Welcome back, Robert Bobby Krutt.
Bobby.
Bobby.
Thank you for having me again.
We're always delighted to have you. And especially this time, we're going to be talking about HBO's Telemarketers in the mid...
Uh-oh. Oh, no.
Damn it.
Damn it.
So annoying. In the mid-2000s, Sam Lipman Stern was a high school dropout working at Civic Development Group, a New Jersey company where he and his colleagues called donors for gifts to various charities. Or should I say, they called Marks in an elaborate scam that implicated the company's wealthy founders, including a Christian rocker with his own infomercial, as well as police unions all over the United States. A few of Sam's more competent fellow callers suggested he start documenting what went on at the company, which provided the initial footage for this true crime docuseries, executive produced by Danny McBride and Benny and Josh Softee. Only the first episode of three has aired so far. We got them all. We'll try not to get into detailed discussion of the second and third episode's plots, although, I mean, I guess it's a spoiler that they don't solve telemarketing scams. You know that already if you have a phone. Fun fact, while I was writing this intro, got a spam call. Let's do the Chen check-in. Bobby, should our listeners watch Telemarketers?
Yes.
Sarah?
Yes.
Dave?
I would say watch the first episode. The value of it as a documentary falls off a cliff for me after that one.
I agree. I mean, it's only three episodes, so I feel like it's worth seeing through to the end, but like it does curdle after the first one. I'll say that. So let's get into some details, Bobby. I originally thought of you for this episode because I knew you had grown up in New Jersey, but then you discovered you had another connection to the story. Please tell us what that connection is.
Well, it's funny. I did grow up in New Jersey. And as we were saying before we recorded, a lot of the spots in the first episode I recognized from growing up, which was mind-blowing. But also my dad, his career was as a postal inspector, which a lot of people don't know is a federal law enforcement agency that deals with a lot of fraud. So I told him, you know, about the show, and he immediately started sending me emails about cases he worked and people he knew, and even who worked on this case a little bit too. Ooh. And it's funny what you mentioned in terms of, you know, the idea that it doesn't solve anything, the show. He was kind of saying, yeah, it's like whack-a-mole with the telemarketing. You kind of slap a wrist and then it pops up somewhere else. And so it was really interesting hearing about that from his perspective. And as a retiree, he had a lot of opportunity to send me information about how it works. And it was great. It was a fun thing to talk about with him. But I found it fascinating because of those ties. But I think anybody would enjoy the show.
Mm-hmm. So postal law enforcement officer. You know, those two worlds coming together in one job. Did he carry a gun? Did he carry a mail gun?
There was a gun, yes.
And was it like the Marines, like he had a dress uniform sometimes? And when he did, he had like a really sharp letter opener instead of a sword?
No. The uniform was very much, I picture him at work. Remember Robert De Niro in Copland with the mustache and the suit? It was that look, definitely. Okay.
Amazing.
Awesome.
Yeah.
We also discussed, Bobby, that you, like me, did time calling college alumni for donations.
Yes.
Although when I did it, we didn't have computers. You did. We used paper. That's how old I am, everybody. So speak on that, because there were parts of this were a little triggering for you, you said.
Oh, yeah. You know, I was a telemarketer in college for a year, and we would call alumni trying to get donations, but we used the same software program, and it was a big deal. I think we're the same age, but it was a huge deal that there were computers in this office on campus. And the little software program that comes up where they show how much people have donated before and all that stuff was the exact program that we used in ours. So it took me right back. I didn't last very long in that job, but yeah, I have very vivid memories. And the show, I think, captures it really well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I did that for donations. I also worked, I'm sure I've told the story on the podcast before, for a collection agency when I was 17. They told us all to say when we left a message, or we weren't supposed to, but if they make you, say your name is Mrs. Sanders. So whenever anyone calls back, they can just say, I spoke to Mrs. Sanders. And whoever picks up can say, I'm Mrs. Sanders. And at that place, they didn't even have any like lists. I literally had a Toronto phone book and just went through the business alphabetically calling.
That sounds familiar.
Hello, is this Mr. Aardvark?
That would be...
I got started from the beginning. Damn it.
Aardvark Animal Control. Anyway. Go to the Discord for a photo of the storefront of this place, because somehow it is still open in my hometown. Incredible. Anyway.
Well, based on what we've seen in the show, CDG and the show, the company the show hired, I'm not surprised Bobby didn't last long, because he's a little sweetie pie. He didn't have what it takes.
Finally, somebody says it.
Everyone who's calling at college is a sweetie pie. Mm-hmm. They just get students to do it, because no one else will, honestly. Anyway, Sarah, I would not say this is exactly a feel-good true crime program, but no one gets murdered. I guess that's also a spoiler to say. Did it feel like you were giving your mind a little cozy break from the fare in this genre that you normally watch?
There were murderers. There are murderers in it.
True.
I don't have to say allegedly. Mm-hmm. Some of these dudes were working, spoiler, from a halfway house and doing really great at it. There's also a guy whose name, his last name literally is Bailiff, which I just thought was amazing.
Uh-huh.
This felt to me like if the Action Park documentary and American movie with the Coven guy had a kid.
Yeah.
Which is it's kind of a value neutral statement. I don't disagree with Dave that it does kind of fall off after the first episode, but there's a DIY-ness to this that is either it's going to work for you and you're going to find it sort of not refreshing exactly, but like you're not seeing quite as many of the like AV cliches as you might see in a docuseries like this. It is too long, because they all are. And in this week's Extra Extra Hot Grade, I will not be a crackpot about that generally, but I liked that. I thought that it was interesting, a little bit different from what you usually see. Watching Patrick J. Pespis trying to interact with a Connecticut senator was really something. Like, you're just not going to get that in every documentary.
Mm-hmm.
This was a good break, but it's still infuriating, obviously. So
the first episode is a good kind of fun, mostly day in the life-ish expose of this wild cast of characters at this CDG calling center and the kind of people that they get there and how they actually mix at the office and all the crazy shit that's going on because, well, first of all, they make good telemarketers because, as they say, they know how to hustle somebody. Mm-hmm. And
That was good. I like that.
You know, because most of them were hired directly from halfway houses. Like the company would literally go to the halfway house and start signing people up to work there. You know, you had everybody from minor criminals to not so minor criminals all working in here. And this guy, he started taping everything that was going on there and he started putting it on YouTube and it was all like early internet craziness. And that part of it was quite interesting. And then those same people try to do the investigation that follows. And they are not good investigators. And that part of it in episode 2 and episode 3, I think if you watch as much as this sort of stuff as Sarah, I understand that it's different, that you might enjoy it from that perspective. But for me, watching it, watching these guys bumble through trying to expose this industry was really frustrating. And on top of the frustration is that they repackaged all their failures as successes in to themselves every time something shitty happened. And I'm like, you know, like that this is a 10-minute coda to the first episode. That's all I needed. That we did, here's this crazy shit. We tried to figure it out. We're too much of a fuck up to really lick it.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? Like that part of it fell down for me. But the first episode, the one that's available, is like entertaining as found footage kind of in it. Found footage kind of way.
Yeah, I agree. I also had American Movie as a reference, Sarah. I think that's a great call. Mm. And similarly, it's the same kind of thing. When I said it curdled, like I agree with Dave where it's like at first, haha, look at these weirdos that happen to all find each other. And then at a certain point you're like, I feel bad watching this. Like these people need actual help.
Yeah. In the first episode, Patrick is like they literally have footage of him like on crack, closing a call. And there's this Patton Oswalt sketch from a bazillion years ago before he was anybody, where he's actually just redoing somebody else's stand-up routine. And this guy was killed at one time and he was on crack. Do you know which one I'm talking about, Tara?
Mm-mm.
Oh, I'll have to dig it up, see if I'm sure it's on YouTube now. But basically, Patton Oswalt is doing this guy. He's on crack. He's up on stage and he fucking kills it. Because he's coming in and out of his routine, yet it kind of made sense in a sort of nonsensical kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of felt like the same kind of thing. Patrick sort of like is a success at this place, even though he's stoned out of his gourd, right?
Yeah.
And that sort of stuff. Like, so that sort of thing in the first episode was interesting. But you have those same people then doing the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
Like at a certain point, a cousin is brought in who actually has film experience. So I thought, okay, here we go. But no. Even then.
It reminded me, you know, it's interesting because I agree. I love the found footage stuff in the first episode. And it reminded me of a couple years ago, CNN had a documentary called Holy Hell about a cult in West LA. I don't know if anybody saw that. And it was all done by this person who had been hired by the cult. Of course, they didn't call themselves a cult, to be their documentarian. Mm-hmm. He left the cult and then he used all that footage to create this documentary. And the same thing where the first hour is fascinating because you're seeing all this. But then once it becomes trying to expose the cult, it just got kind of sad because you see how damaged everybody was. And it's not an investigator. It's just someone trying to bring closure. Mm-hmm. But that first hour was fascinating to just see the footage that no one ever expected anybody else to see, which is similar here where you're actually seeing it, not a recreation. I love that part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. The standard solicitation, as the stage is set, the voice you hear is calling on behalf of a local police department's charity. And if you give, you get a flimsy decal set up top to indicate your support. While I was watching this with Dave, I was like, I have definitely gotten this call in Canada, like not even for American FOPs. Like, I remember getting this when we lived in Toronto still. Anyone else has received this particular call?
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah. And I was laughing watching it because I had a boss at my part-time job in high school, the Blockbuster Video on Route 22 in North Plainfield, New Jersey.
Oh, sure.
My boss used to say, Bobby, come here. You got to get one of these stickers. You got to put it on your car. You'll never get it. And I can still hear his voice trying to get me to put the sticker in my car. So most definitely.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, you got it too.
I got, and like I had the sticker because they had hit up one of my parents or my grandmother. And so it was on my Honda Accord as I was going back and forth to the mall at Short Hills. So yeah, a lot of this was resonant for me. And the fact that their innocence about the involvement of the Fraternal Order of Police is really something. That they're like, wait, they were in on it the whole time? Oh my God. Like, oh boy.
What, guys. Cops are crooked? I mean, holy shit.
Yeah.
ACAB except both of the men's dads on this call. Yeah.
Exception noted. I mean, exactly. But like, this, granted, this process for them of investigating started in a, I would say, more innocent, benefit of the doubt forward time for the cultural conception of cops.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Dave, I know you had a sticker because I rode in the car.
So we had the genuine article on our car. We had the one that came from the Ontario Provincial Police that you could only get if you were, you know, I guess a cop or, you know, a staff member or whatever. I don't know if it actually worked. I know I still got tickets. I can't remember if it was when we had the car with the sticker on it still, but
yeah, no, I absolutely still got tickets.
My dad did get me out of a ticket once, though.
Ooh.
After I got it, because it was like local enough that he kind of knew the ticketing officer. I think he went there and said, can you squash this ticket? That guy said, yeah, sure. But then they also agreed that they would play it up as something super duper serious and like made me go to the office and like sit down and stuff. Like, like there's no reason why all that had to happen. I was like 16.
So your dad was kind of a bastard. Got it.
Yeah, kind of.
Committed to a bit, though.
Yeah.
Love it.
But the good news is that police station was near the Niagara Falls Ponderosa. So I think it probably had a salad bar after. So it all worked out. I just want to go back and say Toronto Open Mic is the name of that Patton Oswalt track.
So the pitch, the way it's weaponized in mid-2020 in the later episodes is like depressingly predictable. Unfortunately, and we also hear in the later episodes how effective it is to call immigrants whose status may not be secure, or even if it is, because they are given to understand like this is effectively police protection. Like you put it on your business door, and then if something happens, like they will go to you first, or they'll give you the benefit of the doubt, or blah blah blah. I already said up top, like they don't fix it. And this, as Bobby said, his dad said, like this is kind of an impossible problem to fix. Like it's the enforcement capacity is so low, and especially for this one because it's all embroiled with the cops, like that's also makes it a political problem too, where like no one wants to take on the FOPs because they don't want them to turn against them in the next election.
Right. And if you also headquarter your shties in New Jersey, graft done with an eye towards at least making it look good that you're trying to look legit, nobody's going to really bother you with that because it's New Jersey. So it's like, this is gross, but our payout system is fair. And like the tiers of achievement in the workplace are fair. And there's no visible asbestos that like local authorities are just going to be like, all right, well, this isn't so egregious that we have to do anything. So we won't.
Right.
This is true of most places on earth, not just New Jersey, but New Jersey's sort of like, I don't know, the callus developed towards certain grift is, it just is. And you're like, well, you know, it's a day ending and why, who cares? Nothing's going to happen. I appreciated that wasn't discussed overtly, but the fact that they got processy about how the companies, like all the scripts the companies use to convince you to go up a tier, and the way that these guys are just like, oh, you're not feeling great. Like some of the snippets of the calls are so funny. Like, oh, she's like, how are you feeling? I got like 5 months to live. And he's like, huh, well, since that's the case, since we're both here, can I write you down for the gold tier today? So I think it's decently processy. It is a little depressing in terms of the intractability of the problem, but it's processy and it's not. Sometimes crime and scam documentaries can insert judgment in ways that they just don't realize in a classist way, especially, or a, I don't know, like, how could you be so stupid way? Because this was made from the inside, and the guy literally says in like the first 5 minutes, I just wanted to film me and my scumbag friends being little pieces of shit. But it's like, okay, you don't have that.
Yeah.
You don't have that judgment of anyone in it for who they are and how they live.
Yeah.
So I thought that was good, but the points about the length and structuring and aptitude of the journalisming are well taken also. So, but yeah, watch the first episode at least.
I agree with that. And I think it does have an empathy, especially for Patrick, until they like let him go. They let him do too much where it's like someone needed to pull this back and like save him from himself.
Yeah.
Let's give our fellow Garden Stater the last word. Bobby, your final thoughts on telemarketers.
Well, you know, I only watched the first episode, admittedly, so I haven't seen where it goes from that point. But I think just in terms of watching the how the inner workings go of something like this, it's a pretty fascinating show. Everything that everybody's saying in terms of where it goes, I'll be curious to see moving forward. But I was certainly pulled in and found it very authentic to the point where I feel like I need to acknowledge the fact that I mentioned the body hair in my opening. As a hirsute New Jersey gentleman myself, I just appreciated the way it started because it felt like seeing everybody I went to high school with on screen. So if you're like me and Sarah and you have that New Jersey background, you definitely should check out this show.
It's time to go around the dial. Our first stop is with Tara.
So I love sports for 10 weeks a year, and those are the 10 weeks that Winning Time is on HBO. Some would say this is the scripted adaptation of Showtime, which they can't call because it's on HBO, but that's the title of Jeff Perlman's book about the Lakers in the 80s. I would say it is a very polished primetime soap opera where people incidentally happen to play sports like Friday Night Lights. The best part of watching the show for me is I'm entirely unspoiled for every historical event. I don't know which games anyone in the NBA won in the 80s. I don't know which games anyone in the NBA won this year. Is the NBA in season right now? It kind of feels like it's always happening, like seasons are 14 months long, but I digress.
They kind of are. You're correct.
Guys, did you know after his first amazing season with the Lakers, Magic Johnson really hurt his knee and had to have surgery and that the team was more cohesive while he was recovering? Maybe you did. I didn't. Also, if any of that is factually incorrect, doesn't matter to me. The standouts in the Winning Time cast are still Quincy Isaiah as Magic and Solomon Hughes as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. In the second episode of the season, only two have aired so far, Devon Nixon got a meatier storyline around how his character, Norm Nixon, anchored the team in Magic's absence, and I got to tell Dave he is playing his own dad, because guess what? Now Dave watches the show, too, and we'll come back to him for his thoughts. But first, in the season one finale, we left off on Jeannie Buss, who's played by Hadley Robinson, feeling slighted because after all the great work that she had done in the organization for her father, Lakers owner Jerry Buss, John C. Reilly, he kind of disregarded her and charged her to try to onboard her two stupid brothers. And in the season two premiere, Jerry and the three kids play Monopoly at his new house, which is the literal pick fair. One of the brothers, and I refuse to learn which one is which, doesn't matter, shows the other brother mercy in a real estate acquisition, and Jerry basically says he's soft, and the whole thing devolves into a huge fight. I am not a crackpot, but there are two ways a game of Monopoly can end: huge fight that gets weirdly personal, or everyone resigns out of boredom and no one actually wins. Monopoly is bad. You can at me if you want, as long as you know nothing you say is going to change my mind. Dave, your thoughts on Winning Time as a season two bandwagon jumper?
It's very watchable. It is like basketball is a candy store. It's just like, you know, those candy stores where it's like, we've got the candy that your corner shop has, but we also have all this weird candy from places, exotic places like England and stuff like that. And your eyes are just darting all over the place. And you're like, I want this. I put this in my mouth. I need to go over here. It's sort of like that, because like everything changes about this show every 70 seconds minimum. The tone of it, the look of it, whether they're using fake archival footage, real footage, fake in-universe documentary-esque looking stuff, or intimate camera on a dolly kind of things. The production of it changes all the time. It just keeps you, I don't know, interested, keeps you on your seat, you know, like keeps you getting bored anyways.
Yeah.
And the basketball of it all, I'm with you. I don't know anything about basketball except that they have some of the best 70s logos in sports world. They're just like very much in my mind. Basketball and the bicentennial are like inherently combined in my mind, in my graphic design mind, as like two things that happen from the exact same mind. you're right. It's a soap opera that happens to involve men dribbling inflated balls up and down a court to throw them into a net.
Yeah.
Tarzan, let's go back and watch season one. I'm like, no, I already know how it ends. They won. We don't need it. So I'm happy to pick up here in season two. And of course, you could just pick it up in season two.
Yes, you definitely can. The other thing I'll say is that there's a lot of like excellent vintage t-shirtery. Nothing makes me more of a poser than this show. I like every episode I'm on my phone. Like, what if I got a short sleeve starter jacket? Like, I don't need that. What if I got a Magic Johnson, like, you know, caricature t-shirt? But I do think HBO should put out like one or two, except with Quincy Isaiah's face instead of the actual Magic Johnson. I would buy it.
I have mentioned this on this show many times before, but the 30 for 30 three-parter Lakers versus Celtics is like so soapy and dramatic. You really don't have to know anything about anything. It's just super fun to look at. And it's like the real dudes. And then it's voiced over by Mark Wahlberg on the Celtics side and Ice Cube on the Lakers side. And they can't have even been in the same room, but they sound like they're about just start swinging at each other with this rivalry. And it's just so watchable because everybody was so charismatic and there is so much satin and the shorts are so short.
They're so short.
And Seattle Sonics gear was and remains all-time champion of cool mid-80s branding. I mean, even if you think you don't like sports, this is very melodramatic and easy to follow. So if it comes on TV and you're looking for something to watch in that vein, 30 for 30s Lakers versus Celtics. I have watched it like 15 times. I never get sick of it.
Thank you for that. If it's on streaming online, I will link that in the show notes too.
Mm-hmm.
For my plug, there is a new show dropping on Netflix today as you're hearing this called At Home with the Furies. Speaking of making entertainment out of sports, this is about Tyson Fury, who is a boxer, I guess, and his family. And it's basically the latest sort of unscripted celeb reality sitcom that is biting the Osborne style, but I wrote about how no other show that's ever tried it has been the Osbournes, which I watched the first three last week to do this, and like, it really is still very good. It's like strangely wholesome even all these years later. So anyway, I'll link that in the show notes. That is at Cracked.
Bobby, what have you been watching recently?
Well, I have to just say something about Tara's that she just brought up, is that our niece and nephew were just here and they're 16 and 14. And our nephew said, while we were talking about music, did you know Ozzy Osbourne had a reality show 20 years ago? So it's very sweet. And it's just funny to hear you mention that. The most recent thing that we've watched that I really loved was Poker Face. And I know that you all talked about it on the show here, but I didn't realize how much I missed or enjoyed kind of Mystery of the Week shows. I don't watch a lot of those usually. I'm usually so immersed in either comedies or kind of serialized dramas that it was really refreshing to watch something where every week, here's the setup, here's how it's resolved. It was just really fun in that way. But there is still a touch of the serialization happening. By the time you get to the end of the season, I don't want to spoil anything, but it really circles back in a fantastic, fantastic way. And it's also made me go back and realize how much I like Columbo and Murder, She Wrote.
We watched through Columbo over the past, I don't know, 9 months or so. And we have gotten to the point where we're now in the 80s TV movies things. And I'm like, all right, I'm out.
Yeah,
I don't know, just like 70s and Columbo are such like a fucking perfect pairing of subject matter and tone and naivete that once you sort of progress into the 80s, it starts to lose it. And I'm like, I want to keep Columbo in my mind as a 70s show. We watched like the first two and I was like, oh, it doesn't feel right.
Yeah,
the 80s changed everything. It really, even the color of the images changed even. So yeah, I agree with that. And this show feels very 70s in a lot of ways too. Maybe it's just her car but it's definitely got that vibe. And it's a perfect part for her. I mean, I love her anyway, but you couldn't come up with a more perfect part. And beyond her, I'm just a sucker for shows that use character actors well. You watch this in every single episode, you're like, there's Judith Light, there's Ron Perlman, there's Lil Rel, there's Tim Meadows and Ellen Barkin. It's just, It's every single episode is so fun. And it's the only show that knows how to use Blues Traveler for dramatic effect as well, if you have not gotten to the...
I think that is a safe assertion. Yes.
Yes, yes. We saw a panel about the show, and Benjamin Bratt talked about how he had to memorize that whole song and he had never heard it before. And again, if you haven't seen the season finale yet, you're in for a treat of the hook variety that it leads up to. So yeah, check out Poker Face if you have not. And it actually got me to get a full Peacock Premiere Extra Plus membership and keep it. So it's a great show. For my plugs, I've mentioned on here before, I have a couple books. My website has links to where you can order all those. But today, since I mentioned my dad, I will plug, he's been a talking head on a couple true crime shows about cases he's worked.
Cool.
So the one that I think relates to this the most is he worked, Sarah, you probably remember Crazy Eddie.
Crazy Eddie
was a big electronics chain, and it turns out that they were defrauding everybody. And he worked that case. And there is a show that you can only get on YouTube now called Masterminds that breaks down the case. So I put a link to it where you can watch the whole episode. It's really crazy and interesting.
Cool.
Is he in that retail gangster book? Someone bought it for me as a gift, but I haven't read it yet. Did anyone call him about that? Yeah, it's like the story of Crazy Eddie and, you know, like the insanity of the most legendary New York retailer, whatever the subtitle is. But
the case is amazing. I'm surprised that they've never made a movie, a non-documentary movie out of it, because all the details of the case are bonkers.
Yeah.
So the link to the Masterminds episode is there with my other plug stuff.
Love it.
I am very excited to watch that. Someone should make a movie out of that, and someone should put Arnold Diaz, Mr. Shame on You, in it. This is a sign of quality for many of us for like tri-state area true crime is Arnold Diaz, to whom I am weirdly related by marriage. Like, he walked past me at my brother's wedding. I was like, wow, it's true. Anyway, I'm not here to talk about Arnold Diaz, although he is a very nice man, and so is his wife, Sean. I'm here to talk about Painkiller. I reviewed it at bestevidence.fyi. Our log line over there is the true crime that's worth your time. I struggled a bit with that rubric here, actually, because Painkiller, which is the Netflix six-parter on the opioid crisis, is a Peter Berg work product, which means that it may not be good storytelling, but it is the most storytelling possible per minute. That is not for everyone, and that his approach here is fueled by righteous rage, both his own and the source material by Barry Meyer and Patrick Radden Keefe, tempers my assessment of Painkiller somewhat, but it may not work for you still. I did watch the whole thing, though, almost in spite of myself, and I didn't really have to do it, but I kept watching it for two reasons, and the first is that the acting is amazing, particularly Uzo Aduba as a DOJ investigator who also has to preside over historical exposition by the metric ton in voiceover. She's so good that you almost don't even notice the info dumping. Taylor Kitsch performances can feel labored if he is not cast correctly, but he is cast correctly here. And if you think this role could really be played by just anyone, imagine Jared Leto thrashing around in it, because no. And Matthew Broderick as Richard Sackler is also thrashing around in the underbrush of about half a dozen metaphorical systems, not his fault. There's like a peeping smoke alarm. There's an unneutered dog. There's just a lot. There's Clark Gregg's ghost with a wig. I mean, take all the things off Peter Berg, okay. Jesus. But I imagine it was pretty tempting for Broderick to cheat to the camera with a Ferris Bueller-y eyebrow cock, because this character and / real person sucks. But he never does it. And even history's greatest acting robot's daughter, Wes Duchovny, is, while not especially well-served by this script, perfectly fine. The second reason Painkiller is worth your time, if you can stomach it, is that I also watched Dopesick and read Dopesick and read Gerald Posner's Big Pharma book, and I still think there is room to be made for us to hear artistic testimony about this horrific corporate felony murder that dragged on for decades, and still nobody has been adequately punished, in my opinion. Some things should be hard to watch, and we should watch them a bunch. If you also watched it, let us discuss on the Discord or in the comments at said true crime newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. You will find my review of that, of a recent Zodiac book that I thought well of, and more than 4 years, good God, of other true crime talk. See you in the comments.
All right, here we go on the next extra, extra hot great. That is episode 256. It is We Are Not Crackpots, in which we will bring some I Am Not a Crackpots to the table. We also bring some of yours from the Discord to talk about. That is available to supporters. Go to extrahotgreat.com/club to join and enjoy that and some Kim Reedness in the coming weeks. And then right here on EHG Prime next week, it is our 10th anniversary of EHG Mark II, correct?
That's right, on Monday.
So we're going to have a look at the shows of August 17th to the 23rd of yesteryears. We're each making a choice. We're going to bring that to the table and talk about those. Maybe something from 10 years ago. Maybe something from 20 years ago. Who's to say what you're going to get? You're going to have to tune in to find out, you so-and-sos.
Game time is going to be something.
All right, I break here. It is time for the extra hot great canon, and presenting this week is our good friend Bobby. Bobby, take it away.
During its stellar 4-season run, Atlanta was never just one thing. It was a comedy, but it was also a drama, not in a dramedy sort of way, but veering completely between the two genres. It was an exploration of rap and the music industry, but also of fame, friendship, community, race, grief, commercialism. The list goes on. It was often an ensemble endeavor featuring one of the best casts on TV, but also frequently featured its stars on their own, giving their characters time to grow independently. Because of this, it can be difficult to choose one representative episode to show all the ways the show excelled. Do you go with Earn's hilarious visit to his uncle in Alligator Man, or the indictment of the record industry in Nobody Beats the Biebs, or B.A.N. shot as an entire interview program complete with fake commercials? Or Juneteenth, the classic episode that expertly satirizes white privilege and appropriation. And of course, there is Teddy Perkins, an all-timer that already sits squarely in the EHG canon. Today, though, I have chosen The Woods, episode 8 from season 2 for canon consideration. While I may not be able to pick one episode that touches on every single theme, character, and style that the show addressed, this particular episode, one of its best, excels at everything it attempts, and shows how Atlanta, by not being bound to the rules of traditional TV, could always create engaging stories. For this episode, it is one that walks us through one character's journey, changing him for the episodes to come. It is firmly a dramatic episode and one of its best. While the show follows its own pace and tone, here I will go in the opposite direction and be very structured in the interest of the podcast and narrow it down to 5 concrete reasons why The Woods deserves to be in the canon. Number 1. A single transformative story focused on a single character. As great as the episodes that feature all the regulars are, there is something liberating about focusing on just one of them. It allows the show to dive deeper into that one person's experience and their psyche. The Woods is exclusively about Paperboy, Alfred, played by Brian Tyree Henry, and takes us through a single day in his life. Doing so also allows 2 important plots to come together and break through at the same time. When the episode starts, Alfred is asleep on his couch, woken up by the voice in the nearby room. It's his mother, cleaning up. Clip 1.
This is a mess. Mm. You ever hear of a trash can? And I know you know how to fold. Get up. You know good and well I did not raise a son this lazy. Get him up now, it's close to noon.
It is, however, the 1-year anniversary of her death, and this blurry vision walks out of the room and he falls back asleep, only to be woken up by Earn, Donald Glover, on the phone, who checks in with him due to the importance of the date before getting into business items. The grief of the day and how Alfred thinks his mother would view him now runs through the episode and fuels his actions. While the episode is fully centered on Alfred, we do get one quick scene with Darius, Lakeith Stanfield, who is cooking in his kitchen, which provides a brief comedic interaction before the drama of the day begins. Shaking flour into a pan, Darius informs Alfred that... Clip 2.
Hungry? Nah, bro, I'm good. You sure? Just learn how to make pasta.
Nigga, when you learn how to make pasta?
In a dream. Yeah, Mary McCheese was there. The girl from Dharma and Greg.
Oh, that's my ride, man. I'll see you later.
I fully admit this exchange has nothing to really do with the plot per se, but couldn't resist sharing a dream with Mayor McCheese and Jenna Elfman appearing in it. Alfred heads out with his friend Ciara, Angela Wildflower, an Instagram famous model who pressures him to shake out of his ambivalent feelings about his career. When the episode starts, Paperboy is in a rut, worrying about becoming famous and not his real self, worrying about becoming a one-hit wonder, worrying about what fame has done to his world. After arguing with Ciara about Instagram, a worthy argument, he leaves her and walks out into the outskirts of Atlanta, lost for a while until running into three teenagers. Clip three.
Whoa! You Paperboy!
What's up, man?
Yo, this is so crazy. We've been listening to you from the start.
Man, we love that new song, bro. I be telling my mama crazy.
I appreciate that, man.
When I tell my brother about this, he gonna trip.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. So what are you doing here?
Just living,
you
man.
You alone? You ain't got no car?
But I ain't allowed to walk.
Oh, you keeping it real. That's a sad.
Yeah, that's right.
Seeing he is alone, they attack him, attempting to rob him at gunpoint. Alfred fights back and runs into the nearby woods where he hides and quickly gets lost. He spends most of the rest of the episode trying to navigate the woods, find his way out, and interacting with an unhoused man, possibly mentally ill, possibly drunk, possibly his mother speaking through someone else. The man seems to come from nowhere and offers help. Clip four.
You looking for them boys? Them bad boys?
Yeah. Yeah, you seen which way they went?
Yeah, I seen. They went that way. Then they went that way. Then they went there.
Nope. Their interactions in the woods will take Alfred through the night and the forest, confronting his grief over his mother and the stasis in his life, putting him back in the city, lit by a local gas station and ready to move forward. Reason number two, Brian Tyree Henry's performance. It'd be hard to say Brian Tyree Henry is an underappreciated actor anymore, considering he was nominated for an Oscar last year. But even with this development, it is worth noting that he's one of the most versatile yet grounded actors working today. There's a reason why at least half the people I recommend Atlanta to think he's an actual rapper cast for the show, not an actor playing one. After his initial interaction with the man in the woods, their relationship turns more confrontational in the night. Clip five.
Then watch how you talk to people, dear Guts. You sit around in people's houses insulting them. You better stand up and make a decision about how you getting out of here.
Nigga, just leave me alone. God damn.
Make the decision.
After this, the man immediately puts a knife to Alfred's throat. Clip six.
Keep standing still. You're gone, boy. You're wasting time. And the only people who got time are dead.
A lesser actor on a lesser show would have leaned into the melodramatic breakdown at the climax of his woods journey. Instead, we feel Alfred holding back tears until he can't hold it anymore. It's an incredible performance. In interviews after this episode was aired, Henry was open about his own life and how his mother died before filming the season. The episode is dedicated to her, in fact, and he channels that grief into his character. Reason number three. The subtlety in storytelling and the confidence of the show. Most shows like to broadcast their big plot points and beats and send out their messages with a siren. One of Atlanta's strengths was its confidence in itself and its artistry. This means the creators trust audiences to pick up on small moments and keys to the proceedings. Instead of stamping this with a very special episode label throughout its actions, we are softly clued into the fact that this is the anniversary of Alfred's mother's death. Anyone he speaks with asks him how he's doing today, indicating through tone that this date means something. He receives a text with the same sentiment, but it is never spelled out fully for us. Even the moment with his mother's appearance is played quickly and simply, out of the frame focus and with a quick bit of dialogue and some humming. This hummed melody reappears in the forest when the woodsman approaches him, who hums the same tune. It is quick, and it isn't played with a sudden stinger from the soundtrack. It just exists there, letting us take what we will from it. This was always one of the strengths of Atlanta, and it's on full display here, the willingness to let audiences infer meaning and plot instead of spelling it out for us at all times. This is a level of confidence not only in the audience, but in the show's storytelling ability. The Woods is a perfect example of how that confident filmmaking plays out, letting shots and moments linger. What other show would linger so long in an aerial shot of the forest, letting it breathe for so long? Or so much time of him lost, silent in the woods? Obviously, being lost in the forest is the key to the episode, but few other shows would actually match the form with the content like this. Reason number four, the direction and the cinematography. The confidence and the subtlety plays out through the direction and the cinematography. Simply put, Atlanta was one of the best-looking shows on TV. Each scene could be frozen and become a gallery-worthy photograph. Each moment lingers on an image worthy of a praised poem. The previously mentioned shots of the woods are clear choices, but there are countless moments in this episode that highlight the skill of the direction. The camera work while Alfred and Ciara are shopping, Alfred sitting under the big crystal sign eating his slider, which made me particularly nostalgic for my time living in Atlanta, and the way the blade against his neck picks up just the right amount of light in the climactic forest moments. The woods is an ideal example of the aesthetics of the show. And number five, the willingness to take big swings. I'm a sucker in any work of art, really, for a piece that takes on an archetypal huge image or concept, risking cliche and tipping over into melodrama, but makes it work. A poem about the moon that actually does something fresh with it, a song where the strings come in at just the right moment, or a movie where characters stand at the shore and look out at the ocean. All of these are overused, hard-on-sleeve elements and can so easily cross into played-out areas. But when they earn those elements, infuse them with real artistry, it's exhilarating to watch. Here, right from the title of the episode, we know we're going to watch something where a conflicted character is going to have to go through the woods, both figuratively and literally. But instead of rolling our eyes at the concept, we are fully immersed in it through the writing, the performance, and the direction. There's not a false note here, and the show's willingness to enter the woods confidently makes it work so well. In the past, when discussing Atlanta with friends or classes, I've pretentiously said that it may be centered on rap, but it is more like jazz, which I know is a bad word in the extra hot, great world. I know. But the way that it's willing to move at its own rhythm, take diversions, take its time, mix it up, feels like jazz. I've also told a poetry class that the show is the closest TV has gotten to being poetry for the way it works with image and tone. Both of those analogies are not only a bit eye-roll-inducing, I realize, but they're also false. Atlanta could only exist in this medium, allowing the mix of storytelling, performance, and direction to work in sync to affect us in this particular manner. The Woods takes viewers through Alfred's journey and out onto the other side, ready for the next episode, knowing it will take us in yet another new direction.
Thank you so much. I'll go first. This is part of a series of episodes of Atlanta where Paperboy is in nature and something bad happens, but he goes on a journey of self-discovery in the process. This in the episode in the final season where he's on his farm and there's a mishap. I won't say more. That's another great episode. This was a lovely choice. I thought as it was closing that it was, and, you know, this is pretentious, I guess, but I'll say it anyway. There's something Shakespearean about it where, like, we don't, he has, as you said, you know, one thought sort of on his mind through the whole episode, this anniversary, and everything we're watching, we're not sure as it plays out, like, what is even necessarily real, starting with the shot of his mother, which isn't, but then everything else, it's like, is it or isn't it? I mean, is this guy, like you said, is the guy in the woods even really there? And yet he's speaking what Alfred needs to hear in that moment to figure out what he is supposed to do next. I mean, in the near term and in his life, both. And there's something sort of mystical about it. And you're so right about the direction. I mean, I know that Hiro Murai, like, he directed a lot of this, but without even seeing his credit at the end, I knew that it was him because it's so gorgeous. I mean, that overhead shot of the woods, it's like,
yeah.
So beautiful.
I was getting Green Knight vibes from it.
Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's like it's real and it's unreal and it's Atlanta and it's not. Like there's when he stumbles out of this journey of self-discovery and he's just like in a parking lot at a gas station. situation. And he's like back in his own life, getting recognized by a fan who is like completely uncurious or incurious rather about Alfred smiling at his selfie with like blood all over his teeth. Like, thanks, just moves on. There's so much going on and it's so economical and so unshowy in the way that it deals with all of these, with this moment in his life. It's any episode that's a showcase for the great Brian Tyree Henry, not a rapper, Yale Drama School graduate, is a good time. But you're right, like there isn't, there's not a weak link in the cast, but this is just a lovely showcase for him and a great episode to revisit. Sarah.
I was struck once again by how comfortable this show and its creators and directors are at just being in pretentiousness trifecta, the liminal space between reality and the supernatural. Mm-hmm. I've taught Atlanta and specifically Teddy Perkins, and like it was the easiest fucking 3 hours of my life. The like, you turn the lights up and you're like, how's everyone feeling? And then that one kid who always talks starts talking. And then it's like just like the board is covered with image systems. And after an hour and a half, you're still not done talking about it. Like that is art. Absolutely. But I was struck once again by, as Bobby said, how subtle it is and how confident the show always is, not just in itself and its own storytelling and its ability to take these like Truffaut-esque dog legs kind of in the middle that it's like, well, he's being yelled at sort of in the plane of reality by Ciara. And she's like, you know, you have to get real, like being real is your brand and blah, blah, blah. And then they get in a fight. And then he's in this like archetypal, like post-trauma ghost landscape, which is like, it's Atlanta. So you believe it. Like you believe that you'll just follow them where they go. But also the show believes in us to just keep up, which I appreciate because that's often not true, as Bobby also pointed out, like very often the soundtrack or like there's going to be a black and white flashback that's like, remember this thing that happened like 12 minutes ago? Like, ugh, fuck off. Like the Glovers don't do that. Yeah. And the cinematography, I think, is an important part of it. And I was struck particularly in this episode, but also in the one where he like he's just on barbershop walkabout, like with the drape on that.
Yeah,
that. He is often shot as though he is his own city state or town or system that other things orbit, like mm-hmm. that he is a planet. They don't make it very obvious, but he just has that. He occupies the role with that vibe also. So excellent presentation, but also excellent like narrowing down of what would be a good episode that is a little more typical of a show that doesn't fucking do anything typically, which is mm-hmm. why we revere it. Like Teddy Perkins is a masterpiece half hour, but this is closer to what the show quote normally is, but it also reflects that it doesn't really do anything normally. When he just comes out of the woods and like, it's been there all along, this parking lot, and the sound effect, like the SFX on his shoes hitting the pavement. And he's just like grieving there, like it's happy tears, except not really. Mm-hmm. It was just, it's really a stunning piece of storytelling and there's nothing else like it. And I wish it could have gone on forever, but I'm glad we got what we did. Dave.
Yeah, there's something universal and very ancient about the story they tell.
Yes,
but in the ancient way it's presented here, it does it within the confines such as they are of this show, that it is both believable and fantastical at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And that mix makes it seem magical as you watch it. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the point where he gets in the woods on. And at the start, I suppose they sort of set the tone with this sort of lucid dream or whatever's happening with his mother.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really have a lot more to add except to say that this episode is written by the same person that wrote the Jackie Daytona episode of What We Do in the Shadows. So how's that for...
Mm-hmm. Huh.
Libby is a land of contrast.
I didn't notice that. I interviewed her last year because she's
Stephanie Robinson.
She's wonderful. She also wrote the Bibby episode, the one with the barber.
Yeah.
Where he goes on that. And it's similar, like, there's an elastic reality in both of these where it's like when you watch the Bibby episode again, just so funny. But at the same time, you're like, anything could happen with this guy, including that he just turns to Alfred and is like, oh, by the way, I'm a djinn. You know, like, I'm not real. Yes. I am a magic person. None of this is really happening. Like, it's just, and it, that's also what makes Atlanta so great.
Yeah.
I love so much that I meant to mention that actually in the presentation that she had written this episode and the barbershop episode, because they're such perfect companion pieces. I almost did the barbershop episode actually, because I love that one so much too. Mm-hmm. But what an interesting scope of presentation of this character by this writer, who's fantastic.
Yep.
All right, let's make this official. Tara Ariano, what say you?
I say yay.
Sarah D. Bunting?
Me too.
Yeah. All right, that means Atlanta Season 2, Episode 8, Woods. You are hereby inducted into the Extra on Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for the winner and loser of the week. Tara has this week's winner.
I mean, winner-ish. Euphoria creator Sam Levinson is the showrunner everyone loves to hate, especially this summer, because he made The Idol and everyone was mad at it. And there were a lot of rumors that came out around his behavior on the set and not great stuff happening. And that had also occurred around the last season of Euphoria. One of his stars, for example, was an adult film star, and he did not sort of protect her, you know, ability to consent and participate in intimacy coordination the way he would, for example, with Zendaya. Like, they're just bad stuff happening around him. And normally when you see his name in a headline, it's because something bad happened. But Sydney Sweeney was interviewed for Variety by past and future guest Dan Daddario, actually. And she said in the course of this that Sam Levinson does not deserve to be completely trashed by the public. And I think that's as good a defense as this guy's going to get, because he seems like a real piece of shit. But congratulations, does not deserve to be completely trashed by the public, maybe just a little trashed.
And loser of the week I have, and that is David Simon, of course, creator of Treme.
Of course.
How dare you make fun of that show?
I thought about it when we were sitting up. How am I gonna start this? I'm gonna make a little Treme joke. I bet Bobby loves Treme.
I don't know if this should go on the podcast, but that was one of our first conversations when I met you the first time I came to your house. I talked about how I love that show, and I saw your face just go.
Yeah. Oh, the homework show? You like that one?
Yeah. So good.
I also liked that show. It's just you and me out here.
Thank you.
Anyways, David Treme Simon also did a show called The Wire, whatever. Mm-hmm. Recently on Twitter, bitching about New York City being a city on the make because he got a $50 speeding ticket for speeding in the middle of the night through a school zone. There's this whole thing that he's complaining about. It was at night. It was a school zone. I was doing 36 and a 25. First of all, $50. You sneeze $50.
Yeah, that's nothing.
Shut the fuck up. You got caught by a camera speeding in the middle of the night in New York City.
Yeah.
Just deal with it. Stop being such a cock about it.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Yes.
Then everybody's like, well, you know, that is the speed limit. Doesn't matter if the school's there or not. You know, maybe you shouldn't be speeding at any time of the day. And he's just like kept on digging himself deeper. It was kind of fantastic. Yeah. There's an article all about it at hailgate.com. And they did a really good job summing it up. So we'll link that in the show notes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, speed will get punished about stupid things. You know what time it is?
Gotta be game time.
It is game time. All right, everybody. This is the sixth game time of the season. Your standings are Tara up top with 3, Sarah with 1, Value Guess with 1. Today we are playing Garden State TV, Name That Tune, a Leonard Maltin-esque game that will explore a TV show set in New Jersey. I will give everyone the debut year and 2 IMDb plot keywords, so you know they're going to be good, of a TV show set in New Jersey. I will also give you the number of characters from that show in play.
Okay.
These would be analog to the notes in Name That Tune. So these are the things you will be bidding on. If you're unfamiliar with this format, this is how it goes. Whoever goes first makes the opening bid. That is how many characters you will need from the bottom of the list going up towards the lead characters that you need read in order for you to name the show in question. So if there are 10 characters and you bid 9, that list would be everybody but the lead character of that show. The next person in order either makes a better bid or challenges the previous person to name that New Jersey set TV show. I will then read the character list. If the show is named, the guesser gets 1 point. If the show is not named, the challenger gets the point. And we follow Doug Loves Movies rules here. So there are things you can do, such as betting 0 names, where you just have to name the show without a hint, or negative numbers, which means you have to give the show and the top X characters in order. I'll review all that once we actually hit those kind of bids in the show.
Okay.
Note that the character list is based on the full cast and crew listing on IMDb, so generally organized by episode appearances, but that's not 100% how it works there.
Right.
When there is an appearance number tie, it generally falls to credit order, so keep all these things in mind as you make your bids, as you give your answers. All right, the order will remain the same for the whole game, so please remember who you're after, so you can be ready with your bid or challenge. Throw it to Picky to see who will be making the first opening bid.
We will start with Sarah.
All right, so Sarah's first. She will be doing the first bid. Then we'll go to Bobby, Tara. That will be your order for the whole game. We've got 12 shows, no grocer equalizer challenge zones, no steel meals today. It is pure bidding, pure answering, pure mayhem.
Okay.
Are we ready to play Garden State TV?
Yes.
All right. Yes. Sarah D. Bunting, 2021. IMDb tags this 1950s and suburbia. There are 13 characters in play.
I will begin with 7.
All right. She's bidding 7 characters. That means I will read from the bottom of the list, give her the 7 bottom characters. Bobby, you either do a better bid or you tell her to name that show.
Name that show.
All right, right away. All right.
Okay.
So, Sarah D. Bunting.
I'm diving right because I have no clue what this is.
Your characters are Mrs. Hart, Billy, Darcy Lewis, Jimmy Woo, Agent Rodriguez, Dennis the Mailman, and finally, Phil Jones. Name that show. Set in New Jersey. Debuted 2021, 1950s, suburbia.
WandaVision.
Yay!
WandaVision is correct. First point goes to Sarah D. Bunting. Since Tara had nothing to do with that, we'll let Tara do the opening bid for question number 2.
Mm-hmm.
A New Jersey show debuted 2009. It is tagged anti-intellectual and meatball.
Oh.
We have 7 characters in play.
5.
All right, 5 to Sarah.
2009 was the premiere?
Yep.
Correct.
Let's see if Tara can name that show.
All right, 5. All right, here we go. Vinny Guadagnino, Ronnie Magro, Jenny Farley, The Situation, and Nicole Polizzi.
I believe that's Jersey Shore.
That is Jersey Shore. Very good character hints there. Everybody doing a very poor job of rebidding so far. Let's see how it goes. Bobby, your opening bid for this show, set in New Jersey, debuted 2004, keyworded atheist and black doctor. We have 11 characters in play.
I can do 7.
7. All right.
5.
5 to Sarah.
3.
Back to Bobby.
Name that show.
All right. Name that show. Your characters are Dr. Jessica Adams, Dr. Lawrence Kutner, and 13.
House.
House is the correct answer. Sarah is killing it.
Well done.
All right. To Tara. Yeah.
Yes.
2010 is the debut year of this show.
Mm-hmm.
It is tagged based on spy movie and Asian lead. We have 9 characters.
Six.
6, she says confidently.
Very confidently. 6.
And name that show.
All right.
Name that show. We've got for you Ryan Fletcher, Sean Pierce, Sonia, Percy, Amanda, Seymour Burkoff.
Oh, no. I don't know. I don't know.
All right, so that point goes to Sarah.
Sure does.
The last three characters, and the first character is probably the only one that would get you there, because it is actually the name of the show. Mm. Alex, Michael, and Nikita.
Oh, okay.
Nikita with Maggie Q.
Sure. Did not know that was set in New Jersey.
I didn't either.
All right, we're back to Bobby for our opening bid for this 2021 TV show tagged Dead Animals.
Ooh.
Soccer. We have 14 characters in play. Dead Animals Soccer 2021.
I'm going to say nine.
Nine characters. It's our opening bid.
He said nine. I'll say seven.
Seven?
Seven.
I can do it in four.
Four. Back to Bobby.
Oh, man. I feel like I'm squeezing a broken Bobby. Record this game. But
she's squeezing
yeah,
Bobby.
But name that show, because I can't right. do more than four.
Four. You've got Teen Mari, Teen Travis, Natalie, and Misty.
This is Yellow Jackets.
It is Yellow Jackets. Oh, everybody's so being very conservative with their bids. All right, this will take us to our halfway mark. We'll start the opening bids with Tara for this 2009 show, tagged Italian Culture, Italian Pastry.
Wow.
Same tag word, if you ask me.
Okay, how many?
Oh, sorry. Eight characters in play.
Five.
Name that show.
Oh, okay. We've got... All right, here we go. Ralphie Boy, Atanasio, Mary Sharone, Anthony Bellafimine,
oh, no.
Frankie Amato Jr.,
yeah.
and Joey Fagno. Joey Fagno.
Once again, I'm hoist by my own petard. I have no idea.
Truly, are there nothing. Steel meals?
There's no, not, but you can
but
answer
you can take
for
glory.
I think, well, because I've been so bad, is this Cake Boss?
It is Cake
Boss.
Oh, my
God.
Yes.
Good
Do
job.
I get that point, though?
Yep.
Yes.
As the challenger, Ooh. You get the point. Ah, this is feeling like a landslide.
Oh, my God. It is a blowout.
All right.
Bobby looking to get on the board. I have one brave little point. Yep. Sarah DeBunting is slaughtering us both with five.
All right. Who's the odd man out on that one?
Bobby.
You'll start the bidding for this 2010 New Jersey set show tagged Murder and, God bless IMDb, Harry Bush. We've got 17 characters in play.
Hmm.
What, 2010, you said?
Yeah, 2010 New Jersey Murder, Harry Bush.
Oh, my God.
Not like the name. It's not like a name. It's not some guy named Harry Bush.
Got it.
I'll say I can do eight.
All right. Eight?
I'm going to say zero. I
Ooh,
think I know
zero.
It.
Okay. So zero's been bid. That means, Sarah, if you want to outbid Tara, you have to go into negative numbers. And if you say, for instance, bid negative one, you'd have to say A, the name of the show, and get it correct. And then B, the top character was how you would have to answer.
Remind me what year this came out?
2010. And to remind you again, Murder, Harry Bush.
Saying one of those really loud and one of those really
quiet.
And
I'm just saying, Murder tagged helpful,
yeah.
Harry Bush tagged helpful.
I think it is, if I'm right. Yes.
Okay. I can't go negative for sure, so I'm going to have Tara name that show.
Ooh, you probably could have gone negative, I bet. But all you need to give me, Tara, is the name of the show. No hints.
I believe this is Boardwalk Empire.
It is Boardwalk Empire. So
oh,
number one character
right.
would have been what?
Nucky Thompson.
Nucky Thompson, yes.
Yeah.
All right. That point goes to Tara. So, Bobby, you will give the opening bid for this 2004 show tagged Nicknames as Series Title and Stoner. Eight characters in play. Nicknames as Series Title, Stoner. Eight characters. Opening bid to Bobby. If you don't know, bid eight. That's what I say.
Eight.
There you go.
Thank you, Dave.
Yeah.
Seven.
Seven.
Not confident.
Nope.
Six.
Six. Back to Bobby.
Five.
Five.
Name it.
All right, name it. Oh, boy.
Okay.
All right. I got to let you know, I think baby seven was the number you shouldn't have gone below for this one. But we'll see. We'll see.
Okay.
Dupree, Little Bit, Bill Blafford, Skylar Blafford, Nancy Blafford.
Oh, all the Blaffords.
All the Blaffords.
Oh. All the little Meridians.
So 2004, nicknames as series title, Stoner, Dupree, Little Bit, and the Blaffords. Both Bill, Skylar, oh, and Nancy. All the Blaffords.
Is it just called Blaff with an exclamation point?
No, that point will go to Tara. Any guesses?
Mm-mm.
All right.
I thought it was Joey.
Dorothea, Red Man. Method Man. That's Method and Red.
Sure.
All right. So.
Oh, duh, of course. But not of course. I don't want to admit that I knew that.
Sarah, 1984. Problem solving. Name and title. 13 characters.
Problem solving. Name and title. Three.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Three. Big opening bid. To Bobby.
You said 1984?
Yeah.
I'm going to take a swing and say two.
Ooh, okay. Two to Tara.
Name it.
All right. Your two characters are Douglas Pembroke and Leela Pembroke.
It's 1984. I need points, so I decided to take this swing. Is it The Equalizer?
It is not. Points to Tara. Sarah DeBunting, you're pretty confident at the start. What do you think this show is?
I wasn't really that confident. I just wanted to goose the game a little bit, but I thought it might be Who's the Boss?
Closer.
It's Connecticut.
All right, so here's your characters.
Oh, fuck, that's right.
Douglas, Leela, Stan, Jill, and Jason Pembroke. Mm-hmm. Then followed by Ellen Powell, Lillian, Walter, Adam, Sarah, and Jamie Powell.
Oh, Buddy that Lembeck, motherfucker.
And finally, Charles of Charles and
Charles and George. Charles. Sure.
All right. Three shows to go. Sarah, opening bid for this 1999 show, keyworded Prozac, Waste Management. 13 characters in play.
Now, remind me, if I bid negative, I have to name characters?
You have to name characters in order. So if you say negative two, you have to say name of the show, top character, number
second
two character.
Second build character, yeah.
Got
I'll,
it.
I'll guide you through it.
Okay. Let's start at negative one.
All right, negative one. Opening bid, negative one.
I'll do negative. This is the year I've been waiting for, so negative two.
All right, negative two.
I'm going to say name it because I know the number one listed, but I'm not confident about who's number
two.
Yeah,
that's right. Why I
so to review.
Started there.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Bobby, you'll have to give me three pieces of information. I need first, and I'm not going to let you know if you're right on anything until you give me all the answers. First, I want the show.
Oh, The Sopranos.
All right. Top build character is?
Tony Soprano.
Second top build character is?
Carmela Soprano.
You are correct.
Hey!
Nice.
Carmela Christopher is your top three.
Okay.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. Great. Finally.
Well done.
So that means, Sarah, you are in the bidding seat for this 2019 show tagged Spiritual Journey and Disabled Character. Seven characters in play.
I feel like I know what it is, but I don't know. Like, the characters won't help me, so I'm going to start the bidding at zero and see what Bobby does.
Name that show.
All right. All I need is the name of the show, Sarah. 2019 Spiritual Journey Disabled Character.
Is that show Stranger Things?
No, it is not. Okay. Anybody know this show?
It's Rami.
It is Rami, yes.
Oh.
Steve is your disabled
character
there.
So Bobby gets the point.
Yep. Right. Bobby gets the point there. All right. Last show. Tara will give our opening bid for our last show. Debuted in the year 2000. Mm-hmm. It is tagged Supernatural Power and Dysfunctional. You have 10 characters.
Eight.
Eight.
Seven.
Seven to Bobby.
Name that show.
All right.
Good luck.
Here you go. Sarah DeBunting. Seven characters. You've got Assisted Living Dracula, Dr. Eugene Merman, MCP Pants, Emery, Oglethorpe, Dr. Weird, and Those are your seven characters.
I have what now?
Assisted Living Dracula, Dr. Eugene Merman, MCP Pants, Emery, Oglethorpe, Dr. Weird, and
I don't know the answer to this. Is it Children's Hospital?
No, that was set in like Brazil or something.
That's
like
right.
That.
Yeah, probably.
Does anybody know what this is?
It's Aqua Teen Hunger Force, right?
The last three were Frylock, Master Shake, and Meatwad the Astronaut.
Oh, fuck.
Three.
Well, yeah.
So you just kind of bid yourself just out of the top.
Yeah, well.
All right, that is it. Let's get regulation scores, please.
Bobby finished with three, because he got that one. Bobby has 3. I have 4. Sarah debunting 5.
Yeah, thanks for almost jinxing me, guys.
All right, nicely done, Sarah.
Fun.
Sarah.
Yeah.
Sarah.
All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We put everything on hold to discuss the HBO doc Telemarketers before going around the dial with stops at Winning Time, Poker Face, and Painkiller. Bobby's pitch for Atlanta made it out of the woods. We crowned winners and losers of the week. And Sarah was a winner of this week's New Jersey Game Time. Next up, we are not crackpots on Extra Extra Hot Great. And here next week on EHG Prime, it is the 10th anniversary retrospective thing. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
let's just film how weird this place is and put it on YouTube.
Sarah D. Bunting.
If you're dead, I'm going to take them shoes.
And Bobby Krutt.
I'm about to go hang out with Mayor McCheese and Jenna Elfman.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Well, where are you going?
I'm leaving.
I drove.
I can walk, ho.